Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor Lacaine. As part of our series on what's working in American cities, we are fortunate to have with us today two guests at the forefront of making life better for citizens. Our first guest is Megan Costello, Executive Director of the Boston Office of Women's Advantage. Following her will be one of the leading mayors in the country, Stephanie Rawlings Blake, Mayor of Baltimore, Maryland, and President of the U.S. Conference of Mayors. We will begin with Megan Costello, who is working with Mayor Marty Walsh of Boston to make Boston the first city to close the gender wage gap. You may have seen Megan Costello on CBS News earlier this week. She's been talking about her major initiative to teach women salary negotiations. Megan Costello, welcome to All Together Now.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted to be here. I appreciate it.
And I thank you for sharing part of your St. Patrick's Day with me. Happy St. Patrick's Day.
Yes, to you as well. We are all wearing our green here in Boston, that's for sure.
Wonderful. Now, you are the Executive Director of the Office of Women's Advancement in Boston, and you have a wonderful mission, which is to advance women toward full equality. There's so much that needs to be done to create women's equality. When you began the job, how did you know what to begin to do?
Sure. So I guess I'll start by giving a little context as to how our office is created. During the mayor's transition a couple years ago, we really were looking in depth at a lot of different city departments and how services were being delivered. And one area that I've always been drawn to is the advancement of women and girls, supporting women and girls, the majority of our population here in Boston. And we noticed that there really was a gap. There was a gap for women when it came to, you know, political office, when it came to business leadership, when it came to a variety of opportunities that exist in this city. And so the mayor gave me the opportunity, and I'm very grateful to him for it, to really take a look at what currently exists for women and girls, but to create a department, not just a commission, but an actual department with real budget, with real staff, to really figure out how can we work towards and with our community partners to, as I put it, enhance the quality in life for women and girls, the majority of our city here in Boston. So, you know, I always say as well that every issue is a women's issue. And so we really could work in every different department. But we know that there are specific gaps for women that we really can and should focus in on. And so with the blessing of the mayor and the support of the mayor, we really decided to, first and foremost, take a look at the gender wage gap. We know it's part of the national conversation. We know that there are some really innovative work being done on this issue, but we also know that there's more that needs to be done. And for the mayor and for myself, it was a question of, you know, how do we use the bully pulpit of the mayor's office and how do we use public policy to impact culture? Because the issues that we're talking about for women and girls are not necessarily reasons that we need new laws, though that laws are important and legislation is important because it does provide those safeguards and those benchmarks for us to get to. But a lot of the barriers that women face, especially in the workforce, are really invisible. And so how do you break down invisible barriers? And you have to do that through cultural shift. So that's how we decided to first and foremost focus in on the wage gap and really take a very unique approach you know, to closing that gap and going beyond legislation.
Right, exactly. You know, it's so important to focus on the wage gap in the sense that when you do close that gender wage gap, you're providing for women's economic empowerment. And we know study after study shows that when you uplift the women, you uplift the families and the community. So women need to have that economic strength in order to run our own lives and to help our families and communities. So it's really stunning to me that here we are in 2016 and that we still have a gender wage gap at every level of income, whether you're talking about, you know, frontline workers all the way up to I was talking to a woman the other day who works in Hollywood, and even the upper level mm-hmm. movie stars for women earn less mm-hmm. majorly than the mm-hmm. higher, the male stars in Hollywood. So at every level in there, we've got a gender wage gap. So I appreciate you focusing on this, and I'm so excited that we have the leadership of Mayor Marty Walsh, who is a longtime friend, and I'm a big supporter of his, that he has committed to being the first city in the country to close the gender wage gap. So that is just such an awesome goal.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think you made two excellent, really important points. You know, this is not just about the right thing to do, but it's about the economy for us all. When women who are the, you know, leaders of many of our families are being paid less, that is not good for the family unit. When women lead the majority of a city like they do here in Boston, for women not to be paid equally, that hurts the entire economy, right? So this is about, you know, bottom line for the city of Boston, but it's also, you know, it's an economic driver for businesses as well. When you pay women equally, when you offer, you know, flex time and paid leave and all of these other benefits that attract women to the workforce, you actually retain women. You see higher rates of productivity for both men and women. And so it helps with the business's bottom line as well. So this is something that the mayor talks a lot about, is that it's not just about the right thing to do, but it's also the economically smart thing to do. And, you know, when you frame it like that, it's really a no-brainer.
Right. It's a kind of a win-win all around. Mm-hmm. So I saw you on CBS News. Congratulations on scoring that. That was an awesome piece that you were
in.
Yeah,
it was great.
Yeah, so our listeners, if you want to see it, you can go to cbsnews.com, and it's on March 10th. And I was not aware until I saw that show that the equal pay law was passed in 1963, but if we keep going at our current rate, the gender wage gap won't be closed until, wait for it, 2139.
Yeah.
So this is something that's not just going to go away on its own that we're making steady progress to. This is kind of a persistent gender wage gap at every mm-hmm. level. So I'm glad you're being proactive and taking action.
Well, and this is exactly what the Mayor Tastis was doing. You know, this is where we talk about legislation being important, because it does move the needle somewhat, and it also provides really important safeguards. You know, for example, the legislation here in Massachusetts will allow for pay transparency, but it'll also allow for workers to talk about their salaries without fear of being fired. But we also know that legislation alone cannot solve these problems, because this is much more about institutional cultural changes that need to happen within a workplace, both by employers and by individual women. And so we've taken a very unique approach here in Boston that goes beyond the legislation. And we say, what role can and should employers play here, and what role can and should women, individual women, play here? So we're offering these free salary negotiation workshops to every working woman in Boston. We have a goal of 85,000 women over the next 5 years. And the purpose of it is not to say this is solely up to women, right, and it's all on you and you've got to figure it out. But the point of it is, we know that women have different, you know, norms that they're raised into, and different expectations as to what the world is going to give them. And we are fantastic advocates for other people, but we're not always fantastic advocates for ourselves, because we've been told that's selfish, that's not good, right? And mm-hmm. so these workshops really are about giving women some very specific concrete tools when they are negotiating for that new job, or when they are negotiating for that promotion. And I think, you know, there's four steps we walk women through. And I always describe it to women as, you know, these 2 hours, this workshop, it's 2 hours long. It's not going to change everything for you tomorrow, but it's really going to allow for you to think about your career and what you want out of it very differently going forward. And the biggest takeaway that we talk to women about at the end of the workshop is, practice this in your everyday lives. We have opportunities to negotiate all the time. And I use something as simple as, you know, when somebody invites you to or asks you for a meeting, you know, they say, you know, hey, Susie, would 3 o'clock on Tuesday work for you? Use that as a negotiation point. Even if 2 o'clock on Tuesday works for you, you know, say, you know what, I'm working on a couple things that afternoon. Would 4 o'clock be okay? You know, it's just an opportunity to practice negotiations, and so this becomes part of who we are and part of the normal lives that we all lead. And then the second thing that we're really zeroing in on is how we work with employers to understand what the employer's responsibility is and understanding the bias that exists maybe in their culture, in their workplace, and what interventions that are data-driven that they can apply. The wage gap is so different for every industry, for every company, and so different interventions need to be applied. And so when, I had one CEO who called me up with pride and said, "Oh, Megan, I'm so excited to report that we don't have a wage gap at the most senior level of our company." And I thought to myself, wow, that's like totally unusual. I've never heard of that before. So I looked up the executives and they're all men. And so I said to him, I said, I really appreciate, what you just said to me, but it's not just about the dollars and cents that we're talking about here, but it's also about where are women in your workplace and what opportunities and what pipelines are you creating? Because until we have more women sharing 50-50 roles, in companies, until we have, more executives and more women on boards, we're going to continue to see these problems. And so, yes, you have to look at the dollars and cents, and we have about 85 companies thus far that report real wage data anonymously to us, which has never been done before in our nation's history, but we also talk to them about recognizing where the actual dollars and cents wage gap is, but where is the cultural, where are the opportunity gaps that might exist, and what kind of things can you do that goes beyond just putting a policy in your handbook that actually influences human behavior within the company.
Right, exactly. Well, that's a novel approach by that executive. That's one way to eliminate the gender wage gap is to not have any women at your senior
eliminate
level.
Eliminate women, right?
Just eliminate the women.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, you mentioned about a very ambitious goal of providing salary negotiating workshops for 85,000 women. Now, that's, I think, half of Boston's working women, mm-hmm. and to reach them in the next 5 years. Very ambitious. How are you going to reach that many women?
Yeah, so sometimes that number scares me. but I also get really excited about it, too. I think, if we're going to impact culture, we really have to go big or go home. If we trained 1,000 women, or even 5,000 women, it would be, something that we should celebrate for sure. But it's not going to dramatically impact culture. What we're trying to do is to create a community of women, at least 50%, right, of the workforce that participates in one of these workforces and talk in workshops and then talks about it with their friend, talks about it with their colleague and ask for that salary, right? Really just create this very organic buzz on the ground, right, that allows individuals to think about this differently in a very large way, because that is actually how you're going to impact change. So we have partnered with the American Association of University Women, or AAUW, as they're known down in Washington, D.C., on this project. It is AAUW's curriculum that we have adopted for Boston here, and they are also helping us raise the money to reach those 85,000 women. So we rely very heavily on our volunteer facilitators and volunteer host sites, and we're implementing sort of a similar kind of field campaign operation, right, of really identifying community leaders, right, that will continue to host these workshops, tapping into their networks of women so that they get them to the actual workshops. We've trained close to 700 women so far since September, and we have a goal of 1,000 this year, which I think we're going to demolish, and then continue to grow it from there.
Oh, that's awesome. And you talked about the 700 women you've trained already in September. Do you have any sense now? I know it's early, but do you have any success stories, any results that's coming out?
Yeah, no, we've actually heard a couple of anecdotal stories. We are doing a pre-survey and post-survey to track each woman's success. But there have been some women. We just got an email actually yesterday of a woman who wrote out, we did a networking event at the beginning of January to kind of kick off 2016, and we had everybody lay out a career goal, and this one woman said, I'm going to get 25% increase on my salary, and I'm going to ask for that this year. And so she set up the time, and she used all the skills that we gave her, and she went from, she not only did she get a 25% increase, but she actually got a 40% increase using the negotiation skills and doing the research that we walked her through. So that was one story that we all just cheered, and we were so thrilled and so excited about. Another story is a close friend of mine who called me and said, you know, Megan, I'm up for promotion. I'm thinking about asking for a salary around $50,000. You know, do you think that sounds good? And I said, well, you know, have you done the research? And what is, you know, what's a comparable salary for somebody in your, you know, city that you're in? Yada, yada, yada. I walked her through the whole thing. Doing the research, she discovered that she should probably be asking for something between 65 and 75. And so she did, and she landed at 72 when she was going to accept a salary of around 50,000. So this just shows you that knowing your value, doing the research, and figuring out how to ask for what you deserve really can be very successful. And I'm looking forward to understanding the data that we're doing as it kind of comes in over the next couple of months.
That sounds great. And what level of women you're talking about? So if you're talking about a salary of $72,000, that's obviously some kind of, you know, upper level management professional. But if you're going to reach 85,000 women, you're going to be going down also. Mm-hmm. You know, does this include like the frontline woman who's
Absolutely.
Working at McDonald's, or what's your mm-hmm. range of women?
Sure. Yeah. So everybody's career goals are different. And I think what is so amazing about this workshop is that you really can use the skills no matter what skill set you have and no matter where you're employed, because these are transferable skills. So you can, you know, you might have a goal if you're in a corporation of going from an entry-level position to a more senior role within the next 10 years, you know, senior vice president within the next 10 years, and you can, like, make a plan to get there, right? Or, you know, maybe you're working at McDonald's and you're making minimum wage, but you want to be the manager of that McDonald's one day. And so what are the types of things you should do to set yourself up for success, to negotiate that promotion over time? And so these workshops are really for everybody. It's from every background, from every skill set. The skills that you'll learn in these workshops, I think, can be transferred no matter what career you're in.
That sounds good. I'm glad, you know, you're including some of those frontline workers, because, you know, we need this at every level, and the women who are working minimum wage absolutely need all the help they can get too, just to try and keep body and soul and family together there. So
yeah, and I think when you're at those front lines, you know, thinking about what are my career goals, you know, it's important to think about that no matter where you are in your job,
mm-hmm.
right? Because whether you're 16 and that's your first job, or whether you're, you know, 55 and you're working at these jobs, it's important to have goals. It's important to set benchmarks for yourself. It's important to understand the value you bring. Maybe you're the most efficient, you know, cashier. Maybe you are really good with people and you, you know, move the line really quickly. I mean, there are things that you do really well at your job. Write those out and make sure your managers and your bosses know that about you. Don't just assume that if I keep my head down and I work really hard, I will get noticed. You have to ask for what you want. And so I think it's really important, no matter where you are in your career, to think about goals for yourself.
All right, that's good. So do you customize the workshop based on whether you're dealing with women who are minimum wage versus women professional, or is it really all the same?
No, it's really all the same, because the four skills we walk through are know your value, and so we have people write out what they bring to the workplace. What are the valuable skills that they bring to the workplace? And so it could be something like very specific, like I'm an excellent surgeon and I know how to handle, you know, like very detailed like that. Or it could be I'm a people person, right? I mean, there's mm-hmm. there's different skills that people write out for what the different skill sets that they bring to the workplace. We then walk them through how do you do the research. So without pay transparency, and, you know, with the fear of being fired for talking about your salary and things like that still exists, how do you understand the research? And so there's phenomenal free data websites out there that, you know, you enter your salary or you enter your job title and you enter the location which you live, and it gives you like a number of job descriptions to read, and then you can kind of figure out where on that scale you might fall. It also talks you through how do you make your pitch. So I call this, how do I get to yes? you have to find the right time to talk to your supervisor. You don't tell your supervisor you want to talk about getting a raise. You tell them you want to talk about professional development opportunities. You know, all of these little tips and tricks that we talk people through. And then the last part, as I said, is really about practicing. And so how do you negotiate, you know, in everyday life? And also, how do you think of things outside of your salary as things you can negotiate? You know, so benefits. Maybe if you're a minimum wage worker, one of the huge benefits to you would to have a consistent schedule. And so think about that as something you negotiate. Okay, we know that this job is $11 an hour, but, you know, and I really want this opportunity and I'm excited to work here. But one thing for me that's really important is a consistent schedule. So can we, will you commit to me that I will every, you know, month have a consistent schedule or whatever that might be, right? That's a benefit. You might not even necessarily be able to increase your dollar amount right away. But if you can negotiate a benefit like that for yourself, that can add huge value to your job.
Absolutely. And you you mentioned at one point about parking. If you can negotiate parking in the city of Boston,
yeah,
you're going to save
right?
several thousand dollars a year.
Thousands of dollars. Yeah, absolutely. That's a huge one.
Right.
You know, that's worth a job in and of itself.
Absolutely. And, you know, there are some people who say that focusing on training women in negotiation skills implies that women are responsible for the gender wage mm-hmm. gap, and it's kind of like a blame the victim approach. How do you respond to that comment?
Yeah, absolutely. And I can totally appreciate where people are coming from when they say that. And that's exactly why we are not just focusing on women. We are also working with employers.
Mm-hmm.
We know that this has to come from many different angles. But we also know that women are not asking right now, and we want to give them some really concrete skills so that they feel that confidence to know how to do this. We, as I said earlier in the call, you know, we're working with employers to understand what the responsibility they have in closing the wage gap, and it's a huge one. You know, employers need to be very aware of who they have in leadership. They need to be very aware of implicit bias. They need to be aware of policies that might exist in a handbook but culturally are not acceptable in terms of corporate culture. And so all of these things are what we're doing with the Mayor's 100% Talent Compact, where we have 85-plus employers that have signed on to committing to reporting real wage data to us. So they report wage data anonymously, and then we help them understand, depending on where their gaps are, you know, so maybe it's, you know, they have gaps at the entry level, maybe they have gaps at the most senior level, maybe they don't have any women at the most senior level like we heard a little earlier. So what kind of interventions are known to work well? A great example of this is a company who, you know, is a competitive corporate business here in Boston, and they were really struggling with getting people to take advantage of a benefit that they offered, which was flexible work time, because the culture was so competitive that if you took advantage of it, it was seen as you're weak, you're less than, right? You're not as committed. And so what they decided to do was on Mondays and Fridays, they said, we're going to make a policy, you know, that no company-wide or big department and why meetings can happen on Mondays and Fridays. And we're going to force all of our middle managers, whether they have children or not, to submit a flexible work schedule. And within a year, that totally changed the climate, right, and the culture of that entity, because it allowed for both men and women to participate in this flexible work schedule. It allowed both parents and non-parents to participate in this flexible work schedule, and it made it normal. And they saw, you know, higher retention rates, happier workforce, higher productivity, and all of these things lead to their bottom line, right? And so This is where we talk about this being good for business's bottom line. And so we're really proud of the work that we're doing with employers, because we know how significant their role is in this job.
Yeah, I'm really glad to hear you talk about that, because I think you've really hit the nail on the head on what needs to happen. There are some people, I know you're aware of this, who say it's not really a gender wage gap, it's really a motherhood wage gap, and that if you separate out and say the single women versus the women with children, it's largely the women with children are the ones with the biggest gap. So when you talk about that flex time and making it seem as normal that people take it, whether it's the flex time or the paid parental leave or whatever the benefit is, normalize it, make it so
exactly.
you know, mothers and fathers take it, parents and
exactly.
non-parents are taking it, then it's less of feeling like you're on a mummy track and more like mm-hmm. we're respecting our workers and their families. And, by the way, it helps the company because the workers are more loyal and productive when you do that.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I mean, I think about it in the sense of I'm a real good morning worker. I get up early. I love to write early. I love to think early. You know, by 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock, I'm crashing. I could really use like a good cardio gym class, right, at that time of the day, right, and to just get my energy flowing again, right? So I don't have any children, but wouldn't it benefit my employer, right? And I could definitely work this out with the mayor, I'm sure, but wouldn't it benefit my employer to understand that I'm working early, I'm getting things done early, and then I go for an hour, you know, to take a spin class or something, and then come back to work? I mean, that just normalizes it for everybody, right? Because you have to do what works for your employees and respect employees, whether they're parents or non-parents, mothers and fathers. And I think the other thing here that I talk a lot about is the role that men can and should play in women's equality. Men have an enormous responsibility here, and it cannot just be up to women, you know, to solve these problems. Otherwise, we would have done it 300 years ago. But it's really about men taking advantage of flex time, men taking advantage of paid leave, because, again, it normalizes it for everybody in the workforce.
That's fantastic, and I know you're making such great gains on this. I'm eager to see the results of it, and I know, you know, other things are down the road. We want to see the gender budgeting. How does the overall budget impact women and men? We can talk more about that in down the road, but that's all the time we have for today. Megan Costello, thank you so much for being with us today and for your innovative, groundbreaking work in Boston.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. I appreciate being part of the conversation today, and happy St. Patrick's Day.
Thank you. Our next guest is Stephanie Rawlings Blake, Mayor of Baltimore, Maryland, and President of the U.S. Conference of Mayors. One of the bright spots in our country today is mayors. Mayors are relatively free of the partisan warfare. Mayors have executive power to get things done, and they use it to solve problems every day. As part of our series on what's working in American cities, we are fortunate to have with us today one of the leading mayors in the country, Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake of Baltimore, Maryland. She was first elected to the Baltimore City Council in 1995 at age 25, the youngest person ever elected to the council. She was sworn in as mayor in 2010 and won election in 2011 with 87% of the popular vote. Mayor Rawlings Blake is also the president of the U.S. Conference of Mayors, leading the organization for all mayors with 30,000 or more residents. Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake, welcome to All Together Now.
It is my pleasure to be here with you.
I have so loved watching you in office, and you've been tested by fire and water. And I'm wondering, kind of looking back, you ran for the Baltimore City Council when you were only 25 years old. How did you know so young that you wanted to serve in public office?
So my father was in elected office since I was a child, since I was about in second or third grade. And I grew up watching him impact our community, and I grew up valuing public service. My parents both taught me that that life was about more than what we could buy, and that there was a significant value placed on what you could give. And I knew very early on that I wanted to be a public servant.
That's tremendous. And you've done an amazing job in office. You served on the city council. Now you've been mayor for 6 years. What do you consider your most important achievement as mayor?
I think the thing that I'm most proud of, the thing that I know that will far outlive my time on this earth, is the $1.1 billion in school construction funds that I was able to get for to rebuild Baltimore schools. Baltimore has the oldest schools, the school facilities, buildings in the state of Maryland. Wow. You know, I'm almost embarrassed to say how old some of our buildings are, but it the conditions in many of our schools are embarrassing. And I knew that we could not convince our young people that education was important and that we valued them and their future if they're going to schools where they can't drink from the water fountains, the ceiling tiles are coming down, that in many buildings that you can't see out of the windows because they're fogged. The list goes on and on and on. And I worked very hard over several years to quarterback the effort to bring this $1.1 billion in school construction funds so we can build new schools. And when the governor signed that piece of legislation, that was one of the proudest achievements in my political career.
That's awesome that you did that. It's just education is so much the foundation for everything in your life. You want a job, you want to have a good life, you need a solid education. And good for you for creating the environment to enable the students to learn.
Definitely. My father grew up in public housing in Baltimore City, the first public housing community in the state. And he placed a high value, my parents placed a high value on education. My dad was one of the architects of the city-state partnership that has helped usher in the next generation of Baltimore City schools, where we've seen a tremendous amount of progress in achievement as well as accountability in the school systems with the partnership between the city and the state. So I really consider that the school construction money a continuation of his legacy.
And what a great legacy that is. I just love to see that kind of rising up. I know education was so central in my own life, and I've just seen it for so many people. And you've done so much with your time in office, so much we could talk about, but, you know, talking about the housing, let's stay on that for a minute. When you became mayor, you launched the city's first comprehensive blight elimination plan called the Vacants to Value, which has been recognized by the Clinton Global Initiative and honored by the Financial Times. And as you said in your recent State of City address, quote, working families have become homeowners, artists have affordable units to live and work, and low-income seniors have a place to call home. Tell our listeners about the Vacants to Value program.
I was very blessed to grow up in a solid and strong community, and I know what that did for me, to have a safe community and neighborhood to call home. It broke my heart to see the conditions in which some of our families lived, that there was blight. Decades, generations of neglect and abandonment had impacted so many neighborhoods across our city, and I knew that we could do better. There had been fits and starts for years to try to tackle this problem, what I will say is one of the strengths that I have shown as an elected official, and particularly in my role as executive, as mayor of the city, is I'm not looking for partial solutions. You know, I'm looking for ways that we can have comprehensive solutions to some of the city's most intractable problems. So we set out to a goal to create a comprehensive blight elimination plan that worked for Baltimore, that took into consideration the strength that we had in our communities, as well as we were honest with the community about neighborhoods that we knew that were not going to see a level of private investment that we could use to leverage the city investment, and we looked for solutions to those for those communities as well. So I'm very pleased that we've been able to tear down so many vacant homes. We've been able to leverage private investment by strategically demolishing properties and also by strategically enforcing building codes. We forced absentee landlords and speculators to fix up properties that they've been sitting on. We've encouraged private, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars in private investment. We created incentives for city employees, for first responders, and for anyone who wants to put down roots in Baltimore. We've created a number of incentives that really make Baltimore affordable for people who are looking to fulfill the American dream. So I was so proud that we've been recognized not just in this country but internationally has a innovative program that is helping to make the lives of the people that we serve better.
Yes, you've done an amazing job with that, and you've been a leader in the city of Baltimore, helping kind of pull the city up and really uplift the neighborhoods, uplift the downtown, uplift the harbor. It's just such a joy to be in Baltimore now. I love to go there and visit to the aquarium with my family. And one of the other aspects that you contributed to the city is that you made it a priority to expand access to healthy food and fight the food deserts that there are in communities that lack access to supermarkets. I believe you're the first mayor in the country to hire a food policy director. What does the food policy director do, and what have you been able to do about expanding access to healthy food?
We know that we can't have healthy communities. We can't focus on the health of our residents if we don't address food deserts. And one of the first things my food policy director did was to do a comprehensive assessment of where the food deserts are in Baltimore. We also worked with our federal partners to strengthen and enhance the definition of food deserts so they fit with an urban model. It was hard to have a definition of food deserts that didn't acknowledge the realities of city living, and we've worked very hard to bring that issue to light with the Obama administration, and we've worked to close those gaps. We started something here, the first place in the country to have a food delivery service where you could use your EBT card or food stamps. If you go to a national grocer and go online with a national grocer and try to pay with food stamps, you can't. But we created a virtual supermarket program with one of our local grocers that allows customers to put their order in, and we create a point of sale when the groceries are delivered, and it is given access to senior high-rises. We have them. We've worked with libraries. And some of our social service offices as point of delivery. So we are closing those gaps, those food accessibility gaps. We've also expanded the purchase power for individuals that are using the food stamps or EBT cards in our food markets. I mean, in our farmers markets. So we double your dollar if you're paying with EBT card up to a certain amount, which encourages individuals to come and use the many farmers markets that we have to get fresh, affordable food year-round.
That's a great contribution to the community there, and it's wonderful that what you've done with bringing fresh food, making it accessible to people and affordable.
And we're not done. We also have a tax credit program that is creating incentives for people to improve their grocery stores in food deserts and also locate grocery stores in food deserts. So I'm excited about what's possible when this legislation is passed.
And you need the state to take action on that?
Yeah, Yes, the state passed the legislation, and I'm looking forward to implementing it. Sorry.
Okay, wonderful. So we know that despite all your good work, violence erupted in Baltimore last April, as it did in many cities across the country. You have been courageous and forthright in addressing it, and I believe have said that most of the violence that's happening is young black men attacking other young men. What do you think caused the violence, and what can we do to stop it in Baltimore and elsewhere?
If you're talking about the daily violence that we see on our streets, there's so many causes to that violence. Part of it is this acceptable culture. We see what's unacceptable. When we have a child that's killed in the crossfire, if we see a senior that's killed in the crossfire, if we see someone who has no connection with drugs or gangs get killed in the crossfire, there's a different reaction. in our community than when we see young African American men that that maybe have a record, you know, that are you know, they've been arrested before, they have ties to either gangs or drugs. Unfortunately, in too many circles in our community, if one of them is killed, there is little concern, and that's heartbreaking to me. That the outcry from the community is not they've been far too often they've been silent, and that's why I did the African American men call to action last year. That's why I continue to talk about it as much as possible, that we have to be the ones to value African American young men, whatever their background is, and we show that we value them by stepping up and giving information and getting these individuals off the streets who are carrying guns. Most of them are, almost all of them are illegal. They don't have any value for their lives or other people in the community, and we have to get them off the street. At the same time, we have to look for opportunities so people don't enter enter gangs or enter the drug trade. And, you know, both of those things have to happen on a parallel track, but we can't do one without the other. We cannot ignore the fact that there are some people who are too dangerous to be on our streets, and we need to, as a community, say enough is enough.
Right. And do you feel like you've made progress in the past year? It seems like things have calmed down a lot from where they were a year ago.
You know, the thing is, we'd seen a significant amount of progress prior to last year. Under my administration in 2011 and 2014, we saw the lowest and the second lowest number of homicides in about 40 years. To have 2015 follow a year when we had the second lowest number of homicides was heartbreaking, because we had seen the progress that we've made. But what I know from talking to other mayors is that they see that with all the work that we've been doing, focused on community policing, focused on reducing excessive force complaints, improving the relationship between the community and the police, focused on reducing violence, if we can have that level of violence with the unrest and the riots and the violent year that followed, if that can happen in Baltimore, we've made so much progress, it can happen anywhere, and it was a wake-up call to mayors across the country.
I think you're right. It can happen anywhere. And I was reading recently that there's some research showing when you have extreme income inequality, that you have social problems, you have higher levels of violence. So I think there can be some deeper trends in our society that go beyond the level of what a mayor can do to the broader levels of the extreme income inequality that we've got now in the United States.
Absolutely. I mean, I certainly agree that we need to do more to close that gap and to create a pathway for more people to be able to provide for themselves and others. You know, that's the work that we've done. You know, with the DNC. You know, as Democrats, we are focused on creating an America where, if you work hard and follow the rules, that you know that you'll have the same access to opportunities that anyone else in our country has. And through the U.S. Conference of Mayors, we're focused on those issues of income inequality and creating pathways for all of us to be able to achieve the American dream. Even if you've made mistakes in your past, if you have a criminal record, it doesn't mean that you're disposable. It means that there are ways that we can look to make you contributing members of our community. I spent the morning with the representatives from the Department of Labor and Department of Energy on the state's first solar job training program focused on those that are hard to employ, that have had barriers to employment. And this program is great because it trains members of our community not for theoretical jobs, but for actual jobs that are available in a growing industry. And it also provides wraparound services so we can make sure that the individuals who we're training are actually ready to take on employment and to maintain employment for themselves and for their families.
That's a great program, and that's kind of cutting edge and where the future is heading as we move away from the fossil fuels into the renewable energy. So I'm delighted to see that solar training coming there to Baltimore. We also know that when we strengthen the women, we strengthen the families and the communities. And I was impressed with many of the women in Baltimore kind of stepping it up to bring peace to the communities and do what we need to do to keep the families together and strengthen the community. What have you done for the women of Baltimore, and what do you think more generally mayors can do to advance women's equality?
I think to advance women's equality, we need to have initiatives and priorities that focus on strengthening strengthening women, whether it's initiatives like Be More for Healthy Babies, where we've reduced the teen births by, I think, 32%. We've reduced infant mortality by 24% during my time as mayor. When you have a mother that suffers a tragedy of losing an infant, if you have a mother that is too young and it has an unwanted and unplanned pregnancy, you know, you are creating significant barriers when that happens, and for women to reach their true potential. So mm-hmm. we're doing things like that. We're focusing on how do we support women small business owners, women entrepreneurs. What can we do to ensure that they're successful in Baltimore? We have a real focus on those things, and I meet regularly with women in the business community, particularly small businesses, to see how we can work together better to support their progress and their success moving forward.
I think that's great. We just had a guest on this show recently who talked about the gender wage gap, which, of course, we know at every income level, women are still earning less than men, everything up from some of the fast food working all the way up to, in Hollywood, the multi-million-dollar contract. There's still a wage gap with the gender, but the worst wage gap is with mothers, and that it's a fact now, apparently, that the greatest indicator for a woman being poor is being a mother, which I think is just stunning, that we're not providing enough supports for mothers, whether it be early childhood education or after-school care or the health services that women need for themselves and their families. I think we all need to step it up in terms of helping the mothers be stronger so they can help their families.
Oh, absolutely. I'm a firm believer in the power of Head Start. We have expanded Head Start in Baltimore to—I don't even know if they call it early Head Start, but it's like ultra early Head Start. Mothers that are able to enroll their kids, I think 2 months, 3 months, so they can really get a head start in life. We have too many mothers that feel like they have to choose between their child's future and their ability to provide for their child. And by expanding Head Start, we are working to create healthy families. I've also expanded the amount of resources that the city invests in out-of-school time or after-school programs every single year I've been mayor, including a big surge last year after the budget had already been expanded. We identified $4.2 million in additional money for out-of-school time programs, with a special focus on finding a way to support those grassroots organizations who have a lot of heart and a lot of credibility in the community, but they may not have the paperwork to enable them to qualify for either federal money, state money, or city money. And we worked with one of our local not-for-profits on capacity building, so those organizations that really had their ear to the ground and had credibility in the neighborhoods that needed them the most, that we could find a way to support them as well.
I think that's just a wonderful way to use the power and resources of government and supporting the grassroots. Like you say, they have credibility in those communities, and help them build the capacity so they can do more. I know in Boston, my husband was in charge of helping to award grants to community groups that would do job training. So there was, you know, so and African American men learning construction. They had a Hispanic group that was working with the Hispanic women to help them with computer training. And it was really kind of a role where the government would steer but not row, that kind of give the resources and guidance to the community groups that are out there actually and have the credibility and can engage with the people that were trying to uplift the skills.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely correct. And I have seen my role as mayor, as a convener, to bring people together to think about doing things differently. Under my administration, this is the first time that there's been a task force to take a look at what we can do to improve outcomes for people that are suffering from heroin addiction. Baltimore's had a history for generations of heroin addiction, and no one had thought to bring everyone, community members, service providers, people living with addiction, people who've been successful in recovery, bring everyone to the table to figure out what are those gaps? Why do we still have such intractable problems when it comes to heroin abuse? What can we do differently? And to be a real game changer when it comes to the way that the city creates pathways to recovery for people living with addiction. And we've seen a lot of great progress that has really been embraced by the broader community. The same way with our anchor institutions. Baltimore is known for being a place where we have excellent hospitals and excellent institutions of higher learning. They provide the bulk of the jobs in the city when they're combined. But no one had ever brought them together to the table to talk about how they can use their purchasing power, their hiring power, to strengthen Baltimore's local economy. And we've done that. And that partnership, that anchor institution partnership, is now a model for cities around the country. For me, it's about breaking down silos and thinking about problems and solutions and not necessarily who owns those problems. Now, if these are barriers to Baltimore being where it needs to be, then I feel my role as mayor is to bring people to the table to solve those problems, no matter whose problems they are.
Yes, and you've done a great job of that in Baltimore and bringing people together, addressing all phases of the community there. I'm just wondering, on this whole we talked earlier about violence in the street, what's been your experience about stopping violence against women, whether that be domestic violence or sex trafficking? I know there seems to be a move to train police to deal with the women as victims and not criminals, and providing that kind of surround, all-encompassing services to help the women get back into a straight and healthy life. But what's been your experience with violence against women in Baltimore?
I think we had to have an honest conversation with ourselves about the way that we were dealing with domestic violence and sexual assault. When I first became mayor, it was clear that there was underreporting, and the way that we were handling those cases was not in line with best practices, and we worked to solve the problem. We didn't brush it. I mean, we didn't sweep it under the carpet. We didn't pretend that it wasn't true. We attacked the issue head on, creating a 24-hour hotline for any woman that felt like they had either domestic violence or sexual assault that was not handled correctly, and set up investigations for that, as well as we created a sexual assault response team to monitor how the city was dealing with sexual assault cases. We also established protocols for around lethality and domestic violence calls, so we could identify women who were at risk of serious injury or death related to their history of domestic violence complaints. So we're using data and we're using technology to track that, to work very hard to address the issues around violence against women, and we're taking it very seriously. As well, we're working to train individuals that are working in industries where there may be women being trafficked, so they can identify those signs, whether it's at restaurants or the casino and things like that. You know, we think it's important that the first responders that work in those areas understand what to look for around human trafficking.
So you've done incredible work as the mayor of Baltimore, and on top of all of that, you are also serving as the president of the U.S. Conference of Mayors, which is an amazing institution. And what is your top priority as president of the Conference of Mayors?
My top priority in this election year, as the country is focused on who will lead our nation for the next 4 years, is making sure that everyone, regardless of what side of the aisle they sit on, has an agenda for America's cities. More than 80% of the population of this country lives in metro areas. More than almost 90% of the gross national product comes out of metro areas. Whether it's our infrastructure or our public safety, whoever seeks to lead this country needs to understand that cities and urban agenda and metro areas have to be core to the future of our country. We have a platform called Invest and Protect, asking the candidates to be very clear about how they're going to invest in our country's D-plus or D-minus rated infrastructure. We have bridges that are failing, roads that are failing. We have water and wastewater. You just look at what's going on in Flint. We have serious infrastructure issues that are, it's not pork. These are investments that create opportunities for our citizens, but it also creates a more competitive country when we deal with these infrastructure issues as real investments. And we're also asking the candidates to understand that we have to protect cities. And that means looking for stronger partnerships with our federal law enforcement, looking for things like we're doing in Baltimore with our war room that has members of federal law enforcement, state law enforcement, along with city law enforcement, focused on our most violent repeat offenders, looking for ways to replicate what we have in Baltimore with the embedding of federal agents in our investigation team, so we're able to have a better closure rate. We've been able to increase the closure rate significantly this year, and I think it's directly related to the partnerships that we have with our federal law enforcement and with the community, who sees us as active and engaged partners in creating safer communities, and we need to see that on a national level.
That sounds like a great agenda. And have you endorsed a candidate for president?
Well, as DNC secretary, we take a pledge to be neutral until the party has a nominee, and I'm looking forward to that time so I can actively campaign. I'm embarrassed by what I see in the Republican race, and I cannot imagine what would happen with the credibility of our country internationally if any of the candidates on the Republican side would be successful in becoming president. I think it would be an embarrassment and certainly not be the direction that would lead to an increase in our stature around the world.
I think that's exactly right. I was recently invited to Iceland, which, as you know, is number one in the world for gender equality, to speak at a conference up there, and I ended up having dinner with Gro Brundtland, who was the Prime Minister of Norway and started the Brundtland Commission, which started the whole sustainable development concept worldwide. And at dinner, we, of course, were talking politics, and what she said was, you know, what is with America and Donald Trump? I mean, how could Donald Trump be getting any traction in America? So it is embarrassing as an American to have him as the main person in one of our two main parties. So I'm looking forward to the election to make it clear that he does not speak for all Americans or even a majority of Americans.
Yeah, it's definitely. I'm just keeping my fingers crossed, waiting till we have a nominee so I can get going, because I'm very, very concerned about what that would mean to the future of our country.
Absolutely vital. And by the way, when I was in Iceland, I met a woman there. Her job is she runs the gender budgeting
for the country of Iceland. I said, what is gender budgeting? She said, they look at the entire budget with an eye towards how does it impact women and men. So I thought, well, let's import this idea into the United States. You know, maybe we could start that with some of the cities.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I'm certainly looking forward to talking to you about that in the future.
Yes. You have been through the fire as the mayor of Baltimore and in the leadership role nationally as the president of the Conference of Mayors. What have you learned about leadership that you can share with our listeners?
You know, I've been very glad to have this opportunity to chat with you and, you know, to end on what I think is a powerful note that, you know, I think that leadership is not gender specific. That no matter what gender you are, as a leader, you have a responsibility to give your best and what I believe should be selfless service, to set an example, the example that was set for me by so many women in public service who were poised and graceful and powerful in their advocacy for their community. And I've prided myself on being level-headed, being forthright and decisive, and bringing a style of leadership that has helped to usher in a renaissance for my city.
And you've done a great job. Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake, thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure. Take care.
In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you want to learn more about Breakthrough Solutions, go to thebreakthroughway.com. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. I'll be back next Thursday. Thanks for joining us. This is Eleanor LeCain with All Together Now.